Okay, I think everybody is on, again, whoever doesn't have the mics muted, please mute your mics so that we can't, you know, the call quality, everybody can hear whatever anybody says. We are continuing our study of The Life Divine, Book 2, Part 1, Chapter 1. Indeterminates, cosmic determinations, and the indeterminable. And we are, I'm not sure what the page is because I have a very old edition, but we are on the paragraph beginning, there is more to perplex us. And I don't want to go in great detail into what we've done. Sri Aurobindo is still laying out his argument, which is that we find ourselves in a world in which we are thrown. We find that we have to make sense of a world which doesn't come with any meaning to us. We first find a functional sense in it. How can we operate in it? How can we survive in it? And then, given the nature of the human mind, we want to find some larger sense in it, a meaning in it. We want to find the where, why, and how of it. But a lot of these answers elude us. At the most, we find some of the questions regarding, you know, the how. How does the machine or the animal function? But even the how is left hazy beyond a certain point. And the why is completely left unanswered. We don't seem to be able to find an evident answer on the surface of things. So this is the nature of our problem of knowledge that Sri Aurobindo is beginning this chapter with. And the long paragraph at which we've stopped now, I mean, where before the one where we are going to begin today, he lays it out, and I think the last lines make it pretty clear. He says, he looks at it from the viewpoint of science, which tries to see this problem of knowledge by taking empiricism as its basis. We only assume what we see or what we sense with our senses and the extension of the senses, and any other hypothesis, any other metaphysics is sort of absented, is taken out of the picture. So there Sri Aurobindo says, essentially by talking about what that yields, he says, these formulae of science may be pragmatically correct and infallible. In other words, we can bring out the various relations among forces in the functional sense of the world in which we find ourselves, and we find that these are predictable. So they are pragmatically correct and infallible. They may govern the practical how of nature's processes, but they do not disclose the intrinsic how or why. Rather, they have the air of the formulae of a cosmic magician. Precise, irresistible, automatically
approaching
successful.
The maximum allowed time for recording a message. If you wish to record further,
sorry about
please
that.
Choose the append option from the menu.
Hello?
Yeah, I think somebody...
Yeah, that was...
I think it's Nadia. She's not really on.
Yeah, I've removed her.
The machine is recording, so if you could just get her off the line.
That's what I did.
Rather, they have the air of the formulae of a cosmic magician, precise, irresistible, automatically successful, each in its field, but their rationale is fundamentally unintelligible. So it's interesting, it's a kind of a ironic reversal that Sri Aurobindo is playing at the end of this paragraph, where science, by its apparent ultra-rationality, ends up presenting the face of exactly what it tried to get away from, the kind of sense of a hidden magician. that underlies these magical formulae that we can understand, but whose deeper sense eludes us. So I think because we hide the questions. So I think with that, we can begin this next paragraph. There is more to perplex us.
Sure. So this is on page 313. I'll ask Dan Wood to read first, if he's online and able to. Are you there, Dan Wood?
Oh, yeah. I just had to unmute myself.
Sure. Oh, perfect.
Okay. There is more to perplex us. Is that the line?
Yes.
Okay. For we see the original indeterminate energy throwing out general determinants of itself, we might equally, in their relation to the variety of their products, call them generic indeterminates, with their appropriate states of substance and determined forms of that substance. The latter are numerous, sometimes innumerable variations on the substance energy, which is their base. But none of these variations seems to be predetermined by anything in the nature of the general indeterminate. An electric energy produces positive, negative, neutral forms of itself, forms that are at once waves and particles. A gaseous state of energy substance produces a considerable number of different gases. A solid state of energy substance from which results the earth principle develops into substance from which, into different forms of earth and rock, of many kinds and numerous minerals and metals. A life principle produces its vegetable kingdom, teeming with a countless foison of quite different plants, trees, flowers. A principle of animal life produces an enormous variety of genus, species, individual variations. So it proceeds into human life and mind and its mind types towards the still unwritten end, or perhaps the yet occult sequel of that unfinished evolutionary chapter. Throughout, there is a constant rule of a general sameness in the original determinate, and subject to this substantial sameness of basic substance and nature, a profuse variations in the generic and individual determinants. An identical law obtains of sameness or similarity in the genus or species, with numerous variations, often meticulously minute, in the individual. But we do not find anything in any general or generic determinant necessitating the variant determinations that result from it. A necessity of immutable sameness at the base of free and unaccountable variations on the surface seems to be the law. But who or what necessitates or determines? What is the rationale of determination? What is its original truth or its significance? What compels or impels this exuberant play of varying possibilities, which seem to have no aim or meaning unless it be the beauty or delight of creation? A mind, a seeking and curious inventive thought, a hidden determining will, might be there, but there is no trace of it in the first and fundamental appearance of material nature. A first possible explanation points to a self-organizing dynamic chance.
I think we can stop there, Dan, and then move on. We can consider that paragraph and then move on. So essentially here, Sri Aurobindo is looking for patterns. And as I said, he is taking an empirical stance. It's a stance where instead of assuming that there is some kind of principle or God. So if you look at the modern world, the world in which we find ourselves, our present, our contemporary way of being, our assumed ontology, we may say, which we all share, is one in which the sense of the material world is the most present to us. In past times and in different cultures, they have had different belief systems, which actually influences their ontology. It really has a very important way in which people experience the world. But we cannot, we've already moved out of that, that there has been a big schism which characterizes the modern, in which to us the material world is the only world that is palpable. And not having a belief system actually in some ways makes it easier for us to look more philosophically at what may be the principles, if at all. So we are conducting a certain kind of probe into the nature of reality by looking at what is in front of us. And this is what Sri Aurobindo is doing over here by first foregrounding the mystery. At first he's saying that those questions have to be raised. We cannot just start by assuming they don't exist. And then we have to look for these patterns, which is what he's finding over here. He boils it down to this sameness with variation that repeats itself again and again. It's very interesting because modern, particularly contemporary philosophers have tended to shy away from asking these kinds of questions. Contemporary philosophy has been an attempt to answer only questions regarding how best to function in this world. You know, we take it for granted and then we try to, you know, look at how the human being can exist. It's existentialism, phenomenology, all these forms are not really moving into metaphysics. Metaphysics has taken a bad rap because it seems to be just a philosophical way of empowering religion, belief systems. So what we find is among all these contemporary theorists, there is only one who has actually, I mean, in the Western tradition, who has actually asserted that the making of concepts, metaphysics, is the proper job of the philosopher, and that is Deleuze. Deleuze says that that is his job because ultimately, there is a transcendental, that there are exactly what Sri Aurobindo is saying, there are questions that cannot be answered. There is a transcendental reality, and yet we can't take it for granted. We can't just say there is a God, we can't understand it, and we just bow down to it. There has to be a relationship between what exists and what is hidden. And it is that we can look for by looking at these patterns and seeing how they operate. In the case of Deleuze also, his primary work is called Difference and Repetition. And it's exactly these two principles that he will also narrow it down to, that Sri Aurobindo says that the world presents itself with these two kinds of principles, a principle of free variation, which seems to be random. So that's what gives a sense of randomness to the world. It's a total play of chance. Every possible variety of possibility is given a kind of an equal slate to manifest so that we can describe this world statistically and it makes sense at a certain level. At the same time, we find that there are persistent modalities that ultimately seem to be varying, that there are samenesses that are stable and conserved in very, very large ways. So it's this, the repetition of this kind, this is, and last time we brought up this notion of the eternal recurrence, which is really that sameness, which is the sameness of the infinite one. There is some one, but it speaks in an infinite way so that it never presents itself the same way twice, and yet you can sense its sameness in every presentation. So this is a principle, this is a truth, and we can see it expressed around us, and that's what Sri Aurobindo is getting to over here. But he's saying that it's hidden from us. So again, to look at how Deleuze will answer that question, the next step he will take is to talk about immanent ideas, that this world presents itself through a kind of substance in which certain ideas are trying to express themselves, which are causing a field to occur in which all the various manifesting possibilities of that idea will start emanating or will start manifesting and trying to find infinite solutions. An idea is really a problem, not an idea as a static reality archetype, but an idea as a problem that is working itself out in innumerable forms. So similarly over here we find that Sri Aurobindo identifies this central principle of theory, of sameness and difference, variation, as the foundation of the empirical world. And he ends by saying, again raising the question as to why is this pattern here? What compels or impels this exuberant play of varying possibilities which seem to have no aim or meaning unless it be the beauty or delight of creation? It seems as if there is something else which is just a quality, a kind of a consciousness quality that is manifesting. Otherwise, we cannot give any name to it. It just is an observation. A mind, is there a mind, in other words? A seeking and curious inventive thought, a hidden determining will might be there. So if we are going to look for a kind of a cause, a sort of a why to this pervasive pattern, the puzzle of this pervasive pattern, we may posit consciousness. Consciousness with its attributes of mind and will. But it doesn't present itself. There is no sign of it. But there is no trace of it in the surface of things, in the empirical reality that we are faced with, in the first and fundamental appearance of material nature.
Any comments, questions around that?
This is John Robert. I was just wondering if Deleuze is familiar at all with Sri Aurobindo.
Actually, I doubt it. Because one of the things is, it's interesting that that's part of the provincial nature of colonial or post-colonial knowledge, that Western thinkers have operated in a sort of a vacuum as far as the Eastern philosophical traditions are concerned. The most that they have got to is Buddhism. A certain amount, you know, of Advaita Vedanta, but, you know, Heidegger conducted certain conversations with Suzuki, D.T. Suzuki, a Zen teacher. But for some reason, Sri Aurobindo, though he was quite prominent in his time in certain circles, has not been looked at by Western philosophers, largely. Part of the reason may be that, generally speaking, the presentation or the mediation between Eastern thinkers, particularly between Sri Aurobindo and the Western world, has been mostly through the lens of Advaita Vedanta, that there's almost a stereotype. And so Sri Aurobindo has somehow been missed out by this tradition. So Deleuze, for example, in his last works is talking about yoga. He's saying, for example, that the way in which we can arrive at a different kind of functioning in this world is through experiments of consciousness. And he's talking about yoga as a vast field in which such experiments of consciousness have been systematized, almost like what Sri Aurobindo is saying in Synthesis of Yoga, in that same kind of sense. I'm relatively sure that he didn't know of Sri Aurobindo's existence.
Shall we read the next one?
Yeah, sure. Unless anybody has anything
to say. Daniel Harris, would you like to read the next paragraph?
Shyam, I can't hear you very clearly. I think there's...
Nothing different that I'm doing.
Yeah, your voice is very fuzzy. It's coming through...
Okay, we'll...
Now you're clearer.
Sure. Okay, sure. So I was just saying, Daniel Harris, would you like to read the next paragraph?
Hello?
Yeah.
Okay. So, a first possible explanation points to a self-organizing dynamic chance that is at work, a paradox necessitated by the appearance of inevitable order on one side, of unaccountable freak and fantasy on the other side of the cosmic phenomenon we call nature. An inconsistent force, we may say, that acts at random and creates this, or that by a general chance without any determining principle. Determinations coming in only as the result of a persistent repetition of the same rhythm of action, and succeeding because only this repetitive rhythm could succeed in keeping things in being. This is the energy of nature, but this implies that somewhere in the origin of things there is a boundless possibility, or a womb of innumerable possibilities that are manifested out of it by the original energy. An incalculable inconsistent, which we find some embarrassment in calling either an existence or a non-existence, for without some such origin, the basis, the appearance and the action of the energy is unintelligible. Yet an opposite aspect of the nature of the cosmic phenomenon, as we see it, appears to forbid the theory of a random action generating a persistent order. There is too much of an iron insistence on order on a law basing the possibilities. One would be justified rather in supposing that there is an inherent imperative truth of things unseen by us, but a truth capable of manifold manifestation, throwing out a multitude of possibilities and variants of itself, which the creative energy by its action turns into so many realized actualities. This brings us to a second explanation. A mechanical necessity in things, its workings recognizable by us as so many mechanical laws of nature. The necessity, we might say, of some such secret inherent truth of things, as we have supposed, governing automatically the processes we observe in action in the universe. But a theory of mechanical necessity by itself does not elucidate the free play of the endless, unaccountable variations which are visible in the evolution. there must be behind the necessity or in it a law of unity associated with the coexistent, but dependent law of multiplicity. Multiplicity of what? Mechanical necessity can give no answer. Again, the emergence of consciousness out of the inconsistent is a stumbling block in the way of this theory, for it is a phenomenon which can have no place in an all-pervading truth of inconscient mechanical necessity. If there is a necessity which compels the emergence, it can be only this: there is already a conscious concealment, a consciousness concealed in the inconsistent, waiting for evolution, and when all is ready, breaking out from its prison of apparent nescience. We may indeed get rid of the difficulty of the imperative order of things by supposing that it does not exist, that the determinism in nature is imposed on it by our thought, which needs such an imperative order to enable it to deal with its surroundings. But in reality, there is no such thing. There is only a force experimenting in a random action of infinitesimals which build up in their general results different determinations by a repetitive persistence operative in the sum of their actions. Thus we go from the necessity to chance as the basis of our existence. But what then is this mind, this consciousness, which differs so radically from the energy that produced it, that for its action it has to impose its idea and need of order on the world she has made and in which it is obliged to live? There would then be the double contradiction of consciousness emerging from a fundamental inconscience and of mind or of order and reason manifesting as the brilliant final consequence of a world created by inconscient chance. These things may be possible, but they need a better explanation than any yet given before we can accord to them our acceptance. This opens the way for...
Yeah,
I think we can stop there, Dan.
Okay.
Also, I think somebody still has their mic on. There's a lot of disturbance coming through, so if you can please have your mic on, please, if you could mute it. So here Sri Aurobindo is taking that very issue that he has pinpointed, you know, the two forces that coexist in the appearance of nature. And he is showing how explanations of the world can derive out of each of these observations. That, and in fact, such explanations derive and constitute reality. So there, he breaks these down to the two fundamental principles of necessity and chance. So, and in fact, there's a very important book called that very title, Chance and Necessity, and it was written by a biologist, a Nobel Prize winning biologist, Jacques Monod. He was either a French or a, I think, French biologist. And he is, it's a very interesting book. It's a landmark book, and he was looking at, it was one of the first books that looks at the molecular basis of life from a Darwinian perspective. And so he looks at how, through chance, you know, pure chance, accidental contacts, the molecular basis of life produces certain formations that begin showing persistence. And that persistence becomes a factor of necessity. So for him, it's as Sri Aurobindo begins that paragraph, which is exactly like that we may talk about, and in fact Darwinian theory is also that we may talk about natural selection is that. We may talk about chance processes that produce through weeding out of the possibilities that don't find a certain kind of stability under environmental conditions, we will end up with certain necessities. In other words, certain types of existences that have repetition and that have forces in them that can then drive them. There is a driving force that emerges in them, like a necessity. So in that case, we may say that we may explain the world with all its various repeating factors, forces, and what seem to be necessities through the assumption of a random basis of chance at the base of things. But we know that, in fact, even in science, even in materials of physical science, in physics, such an explanation has been attempted to supplant an earlier explanation which moved from the opposite direction, the direction of causation, the direction that everything is run by a fundamental necessity, that there is a, which goes back to Aristotle and the fact that he said that there is an unmoved mover, a cause, and that cause moves in a sort of almost a hierarchical fashion in extending its various causation, you know, sort of patterns or sequences. And that would place a necessity at the base of this explanation. And one may say that the argument is not yet closed. I mean, this was one of the major arguments that existed even between Einstein and Niels Bohr, the argument between causation and chance. And, you know, you hear the famous quotation from Einstein where he says, God doesn't play dice. So these can be, each of these can be relative explanations of the world. And Sri Aurobindo is pointing out that in either case, there is a certain something that alludes to the factor of necessity. There is too much proliferation and unexplained randomness in the world that eludes, that cannot be explained unless you go to almost a statistical and random mathematics to look at it. And on the other hand, if you look at this kind of randomness, there is a certain intuition of order that is being missed out. Which came first? Again, it goes back to that original question, which came first? Did the randomness come first and extend the necessity, or was there a necessity from the beginning that takes on an appearance of randomness? So by mechanical necessity, he's talking about, of course, that sort of kind of something without what Aristotle would call an unmoved mover or a cause without any cause, something which already exists by fact of existence and is mechanical from the get-go. So he introduces two kinds of imponderables into this into this debate, and one of them is this he introduces them in the middle and he ends with them as well. Right at the end, he talks about this double contradiction. The double contradiction is that there is the emergence of consciousness out of the unconscious. So that is one. The, in principle, they are so very different that we can, of course, get away by saying that, oh, it's you know, just an accident, you know, consciousness came into existence. But this, in fact, was exactly the big criticism of Jacques Monod's work, which is that he tries to show that purpose, what he calls teleonomy, so that is the sense of purpose, is something that arises out of random sort of interactions. It just happens to reach a certain point where it manifests itself. But purposiveness and purpose, there is a difference between the two. Purposiveness is something purpose is something which, you know, you may find that certain inconscient or just material sort of compounds have a certain purpose, in the sense that a necessity that emerges due to the properties that become stabilized in them. You know, a certain kind of a chemical compound will attract only certain kinds of reactions, for example. So we may say that there is a limiting or a narrowing of the field of possibilities and a necessity in its operations. But when we come to consciousness, it's not just purpose in that sense, but purposiveness, which is the ability to wield a conscious will. That ability is so fundamentally different from what is present in the unconscious or in the inconscient, that Sri Aurobindo says that there seems to be an unanswered question there, that there is really something which seems to be in principle so different that it cannot be explained away through the assumption of either chance or through a mechanical necessity. And then the other one he's talking about is this emergence, the first one is consciousness emerging from a fundamental unconscious. And the second one is this emergence of a mind of order and reason as a consequence of a world created by chance. So that's exactly that the chance argument. It's not really necessity, but the emergence of this mind of order and this power of consciousness that remains unexplained. And that, as he points out over there, can only be talked about if we think of something which is more fundamental, some kind of a conscious power already present in this manifesting world. Now, older philosophers, even Enlightenment philosophers, have approached this problem in a number of ways. And perhaps one of the most cogent ones prior to the appearance of modern scientific thinking is Spinoza, Baruch Spinoza, who talks about the fact that what we call matter is ultimately something which only presents a face of unconscious, but which is latent with consciousness. So it's actually thinking matter, that it's conscious and thinking, but its consciousness and thought are latent. It's not expressed and expresses itself over time. Now, there are others who've also said things of that kind. In fact, even Hegelian evolution may be thought of in such terms. But for Hegel, there was this principle of consciousness, he calls it consciousness, remains separate, and it's almost as if it is conducting experiments. And this has been one of the great problems of the Western tradition, this separation between the creator and the creation, so that there is a sense that this is like a medium, you know, this... There is a philosophical term, hylomorphism. This is a term that is applied to Plato, where the idea of the soul and the body, or the mind and matter, are given completely separate status, and one acts on the other, sort of as a sculptor acts on a rock. So that kind of a model has problems in it. While to think about matter as having mind and consciousness immanent in it, in other words, it's part of its properties, but properties that are latent and not yet manifest, brings us a little closer to solving this problem that Sri Aurobindo has laid out.
So, Devashisda, when we say chance and randomness, is there any real difference between using the word chance and using the word inconscient? Aren't they necessarily the same?
No, not necessarily the same, Sham, because as he's saying, the inconscient can be driven by a mechanical necessity. In other words, the inconscient already harbors a certain kind of an ordered appearance. And this is how, philosophy of physics begins with that. I mean, that was the earlier physics, Newtonian physics, for example, which is that there is a certain kind of a rational order to the inconscient. It's not just a random inconscience, but it is an ordered inconscience.
Thank you.
Geka here. Actually, I was thinking of this cause. Can it be looked at as... I mean, as a hint towards a theistic approach, in the sense that something has to come out of something. Something cannot come out of nothing. Meaning, there is always a cause. There is always a parent. So thing has to have its parent as another thing, like that.
Yeah, actually, that is partly there, because Sri Aurobindo is saying that where has this appearance emerged from? The question of the why remains unanswered. So definitely he's saying that there is something invisible out of which it has come. That's also partly there, because that's why even in Sri Aurobindo's case, there is... it can be talked of as a variety of what is called panentheism, which means that there is a transcendent out of which this entire cosmos has come. But also the transcendent is completely involved or immanent in this creation. So both are true. There is a cause, and at the same time, the cause is the effect. The cause is completely present in the effect. So there is, yes, that is the kind of basis of him. So that, as he says, each one of these so-called philosophies is cogent and complete in itself, but it's sort of, it was one way of looking at things, as it were, which sort of doesn't give complete sort of expression to the other way of looking at things.
Yeah, maybe because it is not complete, meaning it has holes. But otherwise, if you go backward in time, then effect does hint towards cause.
Yeah, effect does hint towards cause. So that's ultimately that cause. I mean, even if we assume that there is a kind of thinking immanence, that the whole thing is thinking matter, which has got certain kind of memories in it. And the idea of necessity, even in that work that I was talking about in Jacques Monod, ultimately relies on the emergence of memory. Memory is not necessarily memory as we know it, but memory in the genes, for example, genetic memory, or even memory at a pre-conscious level. Memory emerges. So there is some kind of memory which connects every causation to a cause. And that sort of persistence is pointing to something which goes back and back. But then if we also assume that the cause is already always present, it's already always present, never sort of separated itself from its effect, that the effect is only a way of looking at reality which is assuming time, then it's a slightly different way of thinking the same thing.
And does Sri Aurobindo indirectly or directly address this idea of mutation that was described by Darwin?
Yeah, he would say for him the mutations are that play of free variation. So, and actually Darwin is also saying that there is a play of free variation that is going on, but Darwin can't explain why such a play of free variation is going on. You know, why should these mutations occur randomly in so many ways, as if there is a certain kind of a great, you know, infinite possibility of combinations that need to be worked out. And in fact, in the early years of Darwinism, this is interesting because today is also the birthday of Aldous Huxley. Huxley's grandfather, Thomas Huxley, was a great champion for Darwin, but also held certain differing views from Darwin. And this was one of the questions he asked Darwin, which Darwin couldn't answer. And that's why he didn't fully endorse natural selection. He said that why should these mutations work themselves out in this way in which so many variations have to occur? So there is a principle of variation. Unless we assume a principle of variation, the sort of vast systematic working out of mutations cannot be properly explained.
Right. I mean, like, especially the selection of time, when to occur.
Yes.
I mean, when will all of a sudden a radical mutation take place?
Correct. So that was also part of Thomas Huxley's argument, that what later has been called the gradualism versus punctuated equilibrium debate. So gradualism assumes that all the time there are random mutations going on. But if that's the case, then we cannot explain this factor of time, that there are these so-called evolutionary jumps. And mutations kind of happen in periods of time, and that's the punctuated equilibrium argument, that there is a timing to it almost. So yeah,
that's very interesting, because as you say it, so could it be said that the gradualism versus mutation
original in conscience, a mind, a will seems to have imagined and organized the universe, but it has veiled itself behind its creation. Its first erection has been this screen of an inconscient energy and a material form of substance, at once a disguise of its presence and a plastic creative basis on which it could work as an artisan uses for his production of forms and patterns a dumb and obedient material. All these things we see around us are then the thoughts of an extra cosmic divinity, a being with an omnipotent and omniscient mind and will, who is responsible for the mathematical law of the physical universe, for its artistry of beauty, for its strange play of sameness and variations, of concordances and discords, of combining and intermingling opposites, for the drama of consciousness struggling to exist and seeking to affirm itself in an inconscient universal order. The fact that this divinity is invisible to us, undiscoverable by our mind and senses, offers no difficulty, since self-evidence or direct sign of an extra cosmic creator could not be expected in a cosmos which is void of his presence. The patent signals everywhere of the works of an intelligence, of law, design, formula, adaptation of means to constant and inexhaustible invention, fantasy, even but restrained by an ordering reason, might be considered sufficient proof of this origin of things. Or if this creator is not supremely supracosmic, but is also immanent in his works, even then there need be no other sign of him, except indeed to some consciousness evolving in this inconscient world, but only when its evolution reached a point at which it could become aware of the indwelling presence. The intervention of this evolving consciousness would not be a difficulty, since there would be no contradiction of the basic nature of things in its appearance. An omnipotent mind could easily infuse something of itself into its creatures. One difficulty remains. It is the arbitrary nature of the creation, the incomprehensibility of its purpose, the crude meaningless of its law of unnecessary ignorance, strife, and suffering, its ending without denouncement or issue. A play? But why this stamp of so many undivine elements and characters in the play of one whose nature must be supposed to be divine? To the suggestion that what we see worked out in the world is the thoughts of God, the retort can be made that God could well have had better thoughts, and the best thought of all would have been to refrain from the creation of an unhappy and unintelligible universe. All theistic explanations of existence, starting from an extra-cosmic divinity, stumble over this difficulty and can only evade it. It would disappear only if the creator were, even though exceeding the creation, yet immanent in it, himself in some sort both the player and the play, an infinite casting, infinite possibilities, an infinite casting infinite possibilities into the set form of an evolutionary cosmic order.
So, yes, here we see he foregrounds that issue of hylomorphism that I spoke about earlier, that we find with beginning with Plato and moving through Aristotle into the Western tradition, the idea of an extra-cosmic creator, that is, a creator who in some sense emanates a creation, but doesn't express, its difference between emanation and expression, doesn't express himself through the creation. The creation is not himself, but in some sense separates himself from the creation, but the creation has the principles that he puts into it. And these principles are at work, as he says, like the thoughts of God. And he also says that this could include the possibility of an immanence, but it's an immanence which remains like a principle inside, not entering into each element, but expressing like a principle. That's more like the Hegelian idea, that there is an idea that is behind the evolving universe. So either an extra-cosmic reality has created this universe and can intervene in it every now and then, putting new things into it, or that there is a certain kind of causal factor inside it, but it remains, as it were, hidden and not inside each of its elements, but behind the whole of it and pushes it, as it were. And only if and when it comes to a certain point can it be recognized. Otherwise, only it recognizes itself in an immanent sense behind the creation. And then he juxtaposes this great historical cry of skepticism to this entire scenario. Now, what's really interesting is that Sri Aurobindo's texts, each paragraph actually, is a whole chapter in the history of human thought. You know, you really can read between the lines and see that he's addressing an enormous scope of thinking that has gone on in human history, and bringing out the arguments as they emerged. And he asks the argument, he asks the question in a very pointed manner. He says that if these are the thoughts of God, couldn't he have had some better thoughts? And wouldn't it have been ultimately, that question has also been asked again and again, that if God was self-sufficient, why did he have any need for this creation? I mean, the question of necessity ultimately stumbles there, because there is no need to create anything if you already are self-sufficient and have everything inside yourself. So these are the kind of questions against which he sort of dashes the hopes of hylomorphism, as it were. And he puts the alternative argument that, you know, that this can only be through an immanence which is complete. In other words, there is no difference between the creation and the creator. The creator is completely present in every element of the creation. And that's why he says over there that the creator, it would disappear only if the creator were, even though exceeding the creation. So in a sense that there is a transcendent, that's why I said it's a panentheism. That is, there is a transcendent, but at the same time, the transcendent is fully present in the immanent. And infinite, casting infinite possibility, exceeding the creation, yet immanent in it, himself, in some sort, both the player and the play. And infinite, casting infinite possibilities into the set form of an evolutionary cosmic order. This himself, the player and the play, Sri Aurobindo may very well be echoing a very famous poem by W.B. Yeats, which ends with this line, you know, which he ends with the line, how can we tell the dancer from the dance? And it's exactly this cosmic dance and the dancer are actually one. It's the dancer's dance that we are seeing. And so that's the way in which he points to the fact that it's God and nothing but God that this creation is.
Devashish?
Yes.
But isn't this idea of the dancer and the dance, is not this the classical Indian idea that the divine is everything, is not outside it?
Yes, yes.
Yes, since the Vedas, right?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yes, yes, Sean.
Yeah. So when we say necessity is like opposed to self-sufficiency, right? In the previous paragraph, when we spoke of chance and necessity as the two possibilities, can it not be that it's something that's neither chance nor necessity, that it's something else? Because on one hand, chance seems very unintuitive. And on the other hand, necessity implies a lack of self-sufficiency. So it seems to me that there should be something that's more than, without getting into, there has to be something else than just these two possibilities that we considered in the previous paragraph, correct?
Yeah, that, exactly. And that's what he's saying over here. He's saying that it is self-expression, actually. So it's a certain idea that is manifesting. And that idea is a self-expression of the being, the only being there is, and it is a self-presentation of that being.
Which makes it conscious and which at the same time makes itself sufficient and at the same time it exists.
Right.
It unfolds.
Right. And every step it takes is its own step. In other words, there is not some kind of extra cosmic agency that is working out from outside the steps that an evolution needs to take. that's what gives it that sense of the idea of a single thing that is at once infinite in its possibilities, that is working out its possibilities in a systematic way, trying to harmonize, in fact, these two contradictions of necessity and chance, of the one and the many. So that's the idea, that idea is the field of, the paradoxical field of possibilities that is being worked out as a self-presentation by the one who is the many.
Thank you, Devashishtha.
Could you please describe a little bit this panentheism, the term that you are using?
Yeah. So these terms are actually also catch-all terms, and many variations can exist within them. So there is the notion of pantheism, for example. So there is theism, which is in any case that all the various philosophies that believe that there is a God, and particularly if we use theism, it's a God that stands outside of the world, maybe in the world in some way or form, but is in relation with its creations and its creatures. Then there is pantheism, which believes that there are many gods, and that these many gods are present in the world. So pantheism in and by itself is something which lends itself to animism, which means that all things in the world have spirits, for example. Or we may say that these spirits are interconnected through a hierarchy of spirits that we can't see, an occult world, an occult hierarchy. So these are forms of pantheism. Panentheism is that there is a transcendent being that can present itself in infinite ways, and one of its self-presentations is this world, in which, in other words, it is both immanent and transcendent. Now, within that, there can be what he presented in the previous paragraph as the possibility that the God is transcendent, in other words, it has created this creation that is separate from it, but it has also entered into its base as a kind of energy or whatever that yet does not enter into each of its elements. Now, in fact, that kind of idea is also a type of panentheism. Now, you may think of that as, in Sri Aurobindo's way of thinking, and if we connect it to the Indian mythos and even yogic thought, if we were to think about a supreme being that remains in another loka, in an extra cosmic loka, Brahma loka, or in vidya as against avidya, and then we were to say that there is a cosmic kundalini, we may say a kind of a shakti or energy at the base of the cosmos, that is propelling it in an evolutionary form to bring out all its various possibilities. That would amount to the second possibility. And that would also be a kind of panentheism. But Sri Aurobindo's panentheism is more integral, because he's saying that not only is there something transcendent, something immanent as an energy underlying the entire becoming, but also present in each element of its becoming as a choice. So that's where the fact of the transcendent immanence as a factor of choice, a factor of conscious will in each of its elements comes in. So it's not a blind necessity, not a chance, but an act of will that is taking place in each particle that is running this world, you may say. That act, that sense of will may be hidden, but ultimately it is a conscious will in each particle.
Thank you so much.
This view also leads to our understanding of the three centers of divinity connected with human beings. So at the human level, these three centers are available to us, and they become one which is the center above the head, which is the transcendent center, asleep above in a super conscience, in the closed lotus of the, you know, above the head, and then asleep below as the coiled up kundalini, that is the immanence of the Divine Mother that is pushing the evolution forward, and then asleep within, in, within the lotus of the heart, as the divine inhabitant and the psychic being that is the will of God in every element. So we may see that consciousness is present in us, but also three major centers of divinity are operating together in us. And this can be seen in every element in this cosmos.
Vince, would you like to read next? Maybe Vince is not online.
No.
Oh, you are. Okay.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, now you can.
Okay. I was asking if maybe there's somebody that hasn't read that would like to read.
Any other volunteers? That's fine. We'll make sure everybody gets a chance sooner or later.
Can you hear me? I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, one sec. It's but an approach. Is that the right place?
No, all the unexplained processes.
Okay, got it. All the unexplained processes of nature would find their meaning in their place if this hypothesis proved to be tenable. Energy seems to create substance. But in reality, as existence is inherent in consciousness force, so also, substance would be inherent in energy. The energy and manifestation...
I think I made a mistake. It isn't that...
Right. Now, on that hypothesis...
Yeah, it's the previous paragraph.
Okay, sorry.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. On that hypothesis, there must be behind the action of the material energy a secret involved consciousness, cosmic, infinite, building up through the action of that frontal energy its means of an evolutionary manifestation, a creation out of itself in the boundless finite of the material universe. The apparent inconscience of the material energy would be an indispensable condition for the structure of the material world substance in which this consciousness intends to involve itself, so that it may grow by evolution out of its apparent opposite. For without some such device, a complete involution would be impossible. If there is such a creation by the infinite out of itself, it must be the manifestation in a material disguise of truths or powers of its own being. The forms of vehicles of these truths or powers would be the basic general or fundamental determinants we see in nature. the particular determinants, which otherwise are unaccountable variations that have emerged from the vague general stuff in which they originate, would be the appropriate forms of vehicles of the possibilities that the truths of powers residing in these fundamentals bore within them. The principle of free variation of possibilities, natural to an infinite consciousness, would be the explanation of the aspect of inconscient chance of which we are aware in the workings of nature. Inconscient only in appearance, and so appearing because of the complete involution in matter, because of the veil with which the secret consciousness has disguised its presence. The principle of truths, real powers of the infinite, imperatively fulfilling themselves, would be the explanation of the opposite aspect of a mechanical necessity which we see in nature. Mechanical in appearance only, and so appearing because of the same veil of inconscience. It would then be perfectly intelligible why the inconscience does its works with a constant principle of mathematical architecture, of design, of effective arrangement of numbers, of adaptation of means to ends, of inexhaustible device and invention. One might almost say a constant experimental skill in an automatism of purpose. The appearance of consciousness out of an apparent inconscience would also be no longer inexplicable.
So here we see he is further testing that hypothesis that he made, trying to show or demonstrate how the various contradictions that have been raised and the various world views that arise from them can be explained through this understanding. So this is the notion of an idea with a capital I, or what Sri Aurobindo would call a real idea. A real idea is reality as idea, or idea as reality. The two the same. And it's because, as he says, it's a self-presentation of the Infinite One. The Infinite One, the only one there is, can yet present itself to itself in a variety of ways, in infinite ways, because that is the nature of its infinity. And one of those self-presentations is that of an evolving consciousness, or an evolving self-representation, or self-realization. And that can only be systematically achieved in the idea if it was going to proceed through a complete annulment of itself, what elsewhere Sri Aurobindo has called the self-oblivion of God, an oblivion of falling into such an abysmal sleep that it doesn't even seem to exist. And out of that, exploring its various orders of existence in a very systematic fashion, but exploring them in a way which allows each one of these layers to occupy a certain kind of conscious will in its self-presentation. And so the beginning point would necessarily be the self-oblivion of God, which is the nature of an inconscient material universe. Matter would present the first, it's not a creation, but it's a presentation. Matter itself is a self-presentation of Brahman. It's Brahman as matter. And there, that's why the whole notion of causation over there is that it is the uncaused cause. You know, it's not that it goes back to a cause, but it is the uncaused cause. And in time, we go back to that point where we realize that it is a self-presentation of the eternal that exists eternally. There was no beginning to it, nor will there be an end to it. It is one of Brahman's ways of looking at itself. And so, in that self-oblivion, it must exist as an order with its own properties. And those properties include the properties of an inconscience that maintains itself through inconscient means, providing a certain kind of a basis that seems to be constant, but at the same time that presents the face of a kind of a random interaction of chance. So that's how, as he says, emerge the various orders of being, each with its own level of necessity and chance. In that kind of sort of idea of God, or idea of self-presentation of God, as he points out, of the complete immanence of Brahman and the immanence that drives an evolution through an idea of progressive systematic self-manifestation of the infinite in the one, that we can explain what we find ourselves in.
This is John Roberts. Yes. There's something that Sri Aurobindo says, I think it's in the Essays on the Gita, where he's talking about the witness or the seer in every aspect of the manifestation. And he says something like this seer, this seeing in every aspect, in every node of the energy, operates within it according to the laws or the nature of that node at that particular place in the evolution. And that was helpful to me in understanding this immanence of this eternal in some particular aspect of the manifestation, that the divine operates just according to that, the nature of that node. But then he also says, and then it's also possible for that operation to widen.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. That's a wonderful observation. I think so pertinent, because I'd say that, and I'm also reminded, talking in a comparative sense, that just as we were talking about Spinoza, there's another Enlightenment philosopher, Leibniz, who actually coined the term perennial philosophy, who talks about a monadology, monads. Monads are discrete elements or discrete beings. And so these discrete beings at all the various levels of the cosmos, he claims each one of them is is a point of sentience, is a point of consciousness that contains the entire cosmos in itself. It's really a perspective on the cosmos which is inside itself. The entire cosmos is in each one of these. But given its place in the cosmos, given its particular nature, it has a certain kind or degree of access and expression to the cosmos. And we may turn it into our own Sri Aurobindo's terminology and look at it from a certain point of view if we think about the human. And say, and as you said about the widening, and say that the being, the point of witnessing, as you mentioned, the point of consciousness in every entity in this cosmos, including inconscient entities, is one that is the self-presentation and self-perception of God. But its active power, its power as conscious will, is dependent on the nature that it inhabits at that particular place of consciousness, in the ladder of consciousness, or in the range of consciousness, or in the range of the evolution. So depending on what nature presents to it, nature creates the possibilities of consciousness within which this Purusha, this witnessing being, can extend its powers as Purusha. So not only as Prakriti, not only as a vehicle of nature, but as a presence of consciousness, as a root of consciousness. So we see, for example, that once nature presents a vehicle that can express material, vital, and mental properties in the human to the extent that it can, this witnessing being, which we can call the psychic entity, extends itself as a new kind of being, the psychic being, that has the property of mentation. And that's where we begin talking about, you know, that occult principle that's spoken of when it is said, man was made in the image of God. This is the image of God. In other words, the fact that we have finally arrived, though at every level God is equally present as a presence, as you say, as a witnessing presence, yet as an active power of will within that cosmos, it is dependent on what is given to it by nature in that particular level of the cosmos. As soon as it is given a certain capacity for expressing, it also expresses a capacity of being. And that's where the psychic being at the human level has the kind of capacities it has, as against the same presence of God in every other kind of being prior to the human. And even greater possibilities will exist once greater nature vehicles have been created for that presence to manifest its own power.
Yes, thank you.
So, if there are no more questions on this, I'm thinking since it's 9:30, Devajita, we can close out for today and continue in 2 weeks.
Sure.
Any other comments before we finish off for today? Okay, so it looks like we are done for this morning. So perhaps there was the next time we can start with some more comments on this and then read the next chapter 2 Saturdays from now.
Yeah, the next paragraph.
Sure. Next paragraph. Okay, thank you everyone. I'll send out the link to the audio in a bit.
Thanks. So, when is the next class?
Next class should be on the 9th of August.
So, 2nd and 4th Saturday, is that how it is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Thank you, everyone. I'll stop now.
Thank you, Debashish.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.